Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Jill Kaufman. Let's talk now about a problem that is $1.3 trillion large, affecting some 40 million Americans. It's college debt. And in the past 10 years, that debt has ballooned to more money than all auto loans in the country.
Of course, student debt we're talking about. And the problem is so large, it's made its way into the presidential primaries as a significant issue. Last week in New Hampshire, Hillary Clinton unveiled her plan to bring down student debt. And here's what she said.
You can certainly get a mortgage on a house and refinance it, but we don't let our students and their families refinance student debt. You know, costs for college should not be a barrier, and debt should not hold you back. So I want to make it absolutely clear that you will not have to borrow money for tuition to attend a four-year public college or university under my plan.
So that's Hillary Clinton's plan on how to relieve the student loan debt crisis. But the president of St. Anselm College in Manchester says that plan, nor any of the other candidates' plans, go far enough. And he lays out his additional proposals in a Boston Globe op-ed this week. Stephen DeSalvo joins us now from St. Anselm. President DeSalvo, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you very much, Meghna. Good to be with you.
It's great to have you. Also with us today from Washington is Sandy Baum, research professor for the Graduate School of Education and Human Development at George Washington University. She's also a senior fellow at the Urban Institute. Sandy Baum, glad to have you back on the show as well.
Hi, it's nice to be here. Thank you.
So, President DeSalvo, let's first of all start with you. You heard that tape from Hillary Clinton speaking in New Hampshire just a little while ago about her plan of students not having to borrow money to attend public four-year institutions. How would your proposals differ from that? What do you think needs to be done in addition?
Well, in addition, we need to get the pricing down to a realistic amount. And I speak about the antitrust laws not allowing colleges to speak to one another about at least a one-time reset of the gross price.
Okay, so let's stop right there because I have to be perfectly honest. I had never heard the words antitrust and colleges together when it comes to talking about the spiraling cost of tuition. Can you explain to us a little bit about why antitrust laws even apply to higher ed?
Well, I can tell you that every presidential candidate we've had on our campus, which are many, do not realize that we are bound by the antitrust laws either. Antitrust laws are concerned about collusion where you would drive the price up. And so the Department of Justice disallows us from having a conversation with other colleges about not only what a realistic price should be, but what the price is going to be for the next year or the following year. We want to have a conversation about how we drive the price, the gross price, down along with the discount rate, which most private colleges incorporate into their financial aid packaging.
But antitrust laws basically presume that where there is collusion, what you'll have is the opposite of what you're saying. You'll have prices going up. What's to stop that from happening in higher ed if you were allowed to talk to your fellow colleges and universities about the cost?
Well, we would suggest that you do it as a one-time window and you do it as a reset where we would guarantee that we are having a conversation about lowering the gross price. So this is not something we would expect to happen over a long period of time.
Mm. Now, I know you have several other proposals in mind, but let me bring Sandy Baum into this conversation. Interesting to start with the federal antitrust regulation on higher ed. Sandy, what do you make of that idea?
Well, I have long been an advocate of loosening the antitrust provisions because I think mostly colleges would like to get together and limit the amount of non-need-based aid they're giving. The issue, though, here is that primarily it's going to be the private nonprofit colleges who are going to be involved in any of the discussions like this. And Secretary Clinton's proposal, and I think the proposals of most other presidential candidates, are focused on public colleges where most students enroll. We need to address all of these issues, but they don't necessarily have the same answers.
I see. I mean, in Massachusetts here, we know that the public four-year institutions, the state schools, can't really. They have their hands tied in terms of tuition and fees because it has to flow through the state legislature. So is that talking about like one one of the reasons that it's private universities that would be having this discussion less so than the public ones?
Institutions, I mean, it works differently in every state, but it is, yes, the state legislature has a lot to do with it. And in many states, there's a public university system, and the system does get to decide, you know, how to set its prices. But the whole pricing and discounting model that is driving the published or sticker prices up in the private sector has an impact in the public sector. But in the public sector, the real reason that prices have been going up so fast is because as enrollments have grown, state appropriations have not kept up. So public institutions rely on a lot of public funding, and that public funding has shrunk. So they're raising their prices to replace that. That's a very different story from what's going on in private colleges.
Right. So, Stephen DeSalvo, before we move on to your other ideas, let me just ask you, why doesn't a four-year or an institution like yours at St. Anselm just do it independently? Why do you have to get together with other universities and say, we will collectively bring the price down?
Well, several schools have tried this independently. What happens is when you have a drastic reduction in sticker price, it is not perceived as a value. It looks like there's something wrong. You're out of step with everybody else. So to bring the price range down as a group makes a better strategic decision in the marketplace, and we can say, you know, here's what we believe to be a more accurate reflection of what it costs to go to college. The increase in pricing over the years, keeping up with variable costs, the discount rates have also gone up in some cases over 50%. So the net price may be lower, but the sticker price is what scares many, many people away.
Mm. We're talking about ideas to help control the cost of tuition, the cost of higher ed, and ultimately the student loan debt crisis. I'm speaking with Stephen DeSalvo. He's the president of St. Anselm College in New Hampshire. He's written an op-ed in the Boston Globe about how to fix the college debt crisis. And also with Sandy Baum. She's research professor for the Graduate School of Education and Human Development at George Washington University. And we're looking for your ideas. If you could do anything other than wave a magic wand, I guess, on how to fix the student loan debt crisis, what would it be? Give us your ideas at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also send us a tweet at Radio Boston. President DeSalvo, so we talked about relaxing antitrust regulation on higher ed for a year, but what about the actual loans and payment plans themselves? You had some ideas there.
Well, I'm a big proponent of creating income contingent loan repayment programs where students would pay back some percentage of their income over a variable time period. Right now, students take out loans and they pay back a fixed amount over a fixed time. And if you are making a substantial amount of money out of college, it really doesn't affect you that much, and you still have disposable income. And if you go into service sector jobs or you become a teacher and you are at the lower end of the income bracket, you're paying the same amount as the investment banker right out of college, and you do not have any disposable income, and you can't save to buy a house or buy a car or save money for the future. So income contingent programs exist in England. They exist in Australia. They've worked very, very well. The payment structure many times is automatically tied to your income. So imagine a deduction like Social Security coming out to pay your student loan. What happens there is the default rates goes down to zero, and it makes much more sense for folks to be able to afford the payments by fixing the cap on the interest so that the teacher is not paying more than the investment banker is.
Sandy Baum, this is the one part of President DeSalvo's plan that really sort of made intuitive sense to me. We're not retiring debt here in any way, shape, or form, unlike some current programs that the federal government has on offer. We're just linking it to income. Does that sound like a good idea?
It's a great idea, but it already exists. So we do have for your federal student loans, income-based repayment, and where you can pay back just a percentage of your discretionary income. No one has to pay unless their income is above 150% of the poverty line, and then they pay a small percentage of that. The Obama administration has actually made that much more generous over time, and a number of the presidential candidates on both sides of the aisle, in addition to almost every policy analyst who's looked at this, says absolutely income-based repayment. It would be improved if it were automatic and if the payments were collected through the tax system. Not quite as simple as it sounds. So there's a long way to go to make it better. An increasing number of students are participating in this program, and it does make sense.
But Sandy, if I may interject here, because I think I'd love to get a point of clarification here, because we were trying to figure this out ourselves today. The plan that you're talking about, does that not also include a retirement or a forgiveness of the debt after 15 to 20 years?
It does. If you're in public service employment, for example, if you're a teacher and you make your payments under this program for 10 years, the remainder of your debt will be forgiven. For other people, it's either after 20 years or 25 years of payments that are consistent with your income, appropriate for your income, then the remaining balances do get forgiven. We can, you know, some people think that shouldn't be part of it. Some people think it should be more generous. But right now, yes, your balances will be forgiven if your income is not, over the long run, high enough to support the payment.
Right. It seems as if President DeSalvo's plan doesn't include a forgiveness portion, but just sort of a moderated repayment structure based on your income throughout the life of the loan.
Yeah, and I'm suggesting that this should be the standard, not an option. And so there are some plans like this that people can elect into. Most families, when their child enrolls in college, don't realize that this is an option, and so they take the standard plan, which is that fixed rate over a fixed time.
Mm. Let's take a call here. Chris is calling from Waltham. You're on the air, Chris.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. You know, I think of trying to get the sticker price down for college is a great idea, but I think in practice that's going to be extremely hard. I think one of the options you could possibly entertain is that you could take pre-tax dollars and apply it to your federal student loan, thereby reducing your actual income and your taxable income, and so you could sort of offset some money that way. I think that would go a long way to helping people with disposable income and help a little bit of the financial burden. And then one of the things I want to talk about is this income-based repayment. You know, I went to medical school. I owe over $250,000. I just graduated, and I'm scheduled to make my payments until the year 2046. And I'm paying over $1,600 per month for 30 years. And so, you know, I do make a decent living as being a physician, but it's still an incredible amount of money. And I went to a public school for my medical school. And so some of my friends are in debt $500,000. And I think at some point this has to stop. And my interest rate is over 5.5%. I think refinancing at a more reasonable rate, say 3% or 2%, would be much more beneficial.
Chris, thank you so much for your call. And while you're talking about interest rates, let's turn to Tim, who's calling from Arlington. Tim, you have a thought on interest rates?
Yes, I do. It's also in conjunction with the income-based repayment plan. I am also on the income-based repayment plan at this point, but my interest rate is 6.75%. And because I'm not in a high-paying job, at the end of the year, even though I'm paying my student loan payments, I get a notice that interest is being capitalized and added back into my student loan balance. So my balance is actually going up over time instead of down.
Wow. Tim, thank you so much for your call. President DeSalvo, a couple of perspectives right there on just the simple interest rate challenges that people holding a lot of student debt have.
Well, I do think that the issue of being able to pay on a pre-tax basis is solved if, in fact, it's tied to either the tax system or an automatic payment out of your paycheck. So those things exist. We would have to tie it into the IRS system, which is expensive, although there have been folks that have modeled this and see a break-even event in 2 to 3 years because the default rates are going to go down. The interest rates are a whole other issue, and that, you know, that is something that we would have to look at and determine what is a reasonable amount and how are you able to, if you couple both ideas, right? If the gross price is coming down and the out of pocket is less, and then you have an income-based repayment program, what percentage on average would make sense? And do you fix that, or do you create some kind of variable rate for folks?
Mm. Sandy Baum, your thoughts on that?
Well, first of all, interest on student loans is actually deductible for people under a certain income level and up to a certain amount. So that idea that that it should be deductible is already there. Of course, if you're really a low-income person and you don't have an income tax burden, this doesn't help you very much. I would say the caller's point about your debt growing instead of shrinking as you make your payments is a really important one. A surprising number of borrowers are finding themselves in that situation, and it really would make sense to cap the amount that your principal could grow. I mean, if you can't afford to pay the interest, then having that add to your debt and having your debt mushroom, you're not going to be able to pay that back either. So that would be a way that we could strengthen income-based repayment. But let me just say that the medical school issue is a huge problem.
Right.
Because here the problem is, can we make medical school cheaper? Because it's going to be really hard to convince the average taxpayer that they should be spending the money to do even more to subsidize the medical students so that they have less debt. This is a very complicated problem.
Let's take a call from Julie, who's calling from Andover. You're on the air, Julie.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think all the points that are being brought forth are fantastic, and I think it's a multifaceted problem, and therefore the solution likewise has to be multifaceted. But I think that more can be done from a cost control perspective. I work in healthcare, and we're looking for ways to cut costs. Businesses are looking for ways to cut costs. I know that education doesn't quite follow the same variables that apply to other sectors of the market, but they should really be held accountable like everyone else.
Julie, thank you so much for your call, because I think you get to a very, very, very important part of this conversation. And Stephen DeSalvo, I mean, I can't agree with Julie more, to be perfectly honest, because we can figure out as many ways as possible under the sun to help people manage their debt. But if the sheer number of dollars that it costs to go to school rises and rises and rises with every passing year, what good are we doing if we're not addressing the cost control side of things?
Well, I think that has really begun to change, and you're getting more folks that have business backgrounds that understand, what the structure is like. We have seen a net increase of 1% each of the past 5 years on our costs. We're trying to control it as best we can, and I know a lot of my peer institutions are doing the same thing. The variable costs, the heat, to light the place, that of course is, you know, out of our control. But what we've gotten away from, I think higher education for a while was going a little bit crazy on trying to build infrastructure to appeal to the masses and buildings and facilities that were probably a little bit more opulent. And when, you know, we've gotten back to the core business of it's about teaching, it's about learning, it's about creating career services for our students and success, and managing the costs is absolutely part of the equation.
Mm. Sandy Baum, this question that I've got on my mind is maybe kind of too simple a one, but it's one that people do bring up. And how much is part of the problem here that there seems to have been just an open spigot of money from the federal government vis-a-vis the student loans that are available? And that is one that a lot of people say that is one of the cost drivers. It's sort of this virtuous or terribly virtuous circle.
Well, let me say first that in the public sector where most people go to college, if you look at costs, the actual expenditures of institutions, they really haven't been going up very much at all. In community colleges, they've actually gone down. Tuition has been going up. The price that people pay has been going up. But that's because tuition revenues are replacing those state funds that used to be more forthcoming. So that doesn't mean that colleges can't get more efficient. They can save money. But that the reason that those prices have gone up is not because the colleges are spending more money, because they're not.
Yeah.
The question of whether or not federal student aid is driving tuition, there's been a lot of research on this. And the reality is that the evidence suggests that this is not in any way the main explanation for why prices are going up. I mean, it's just There are cost explanations. We are providing different products than we provided a generation ago. A lot of the inputs have gotten more expensive. It's really not about student aid. If we didn't have student aid, many fewer people would be able to go to college. So we want to be careful about if we could lower the sticker price, but we took away the student aid, people would be paying more, and people would be struggling more because the whole point of student aid is to help people pay for college.
Well, President DeSalvo has a couple more points in his plan, which include limiting the number of higher-income families who can take out low-interest student loans or government-backed loans and restricting the number of loans available for for-profit institutions. And if you want to get more information on that, we have a link to his op-ed at radioboston.org. But in the last minute or so that we have, President DeSalvo, I wanted to ask you, you are president of St. Anselm College in Manchester, New Hampshire. So in a way, you've got the kind of access to presidential candidates that virtually no one outside of New Hampshire does. You've been able to speak to all of them about the student debt crisis. Are you seeing a certain receptivity to your ideas that perhaps you didn't see in previous primary cycles?
I have, and that's what's been interesting. And we had been having these conversations, as you say, with the candidates because we host the First in the Nation primary debate. And they've all been up on our campus. The antitrust issue is a surprise to, I would say, every person that's been here so far. But it's opened up a very good dialogue about how that can change. And now as we talk about the income-based repayment as a standard, I think we're going to get more folks paying some attention to that issue as well.
Mm. And Sandy Baum, you've been taking a look at this issue for a long, long time. Do you think that there's actually the momentum in this election season for actual policy changes to come out the other end when whoever the new president might be?
I do think so. I think that certainly the idea of making loans easier to pay back, its time has come, simplifying the aid system. But really important is the kind of suggestion that involves getting the federal government to take more responsibility for ensuring that students across the country have educational opportunity and don't have payments that are too burdensome. The federal government is going to have to get involved if we want to solve this problem.
Sandy Baum is a senior fellow at the Urban Institute and research professor for the Graduate School of Education and Human Development at George Washington University. Always a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Stephen DeSalvo, president of St. Anselm College in Manchester, New Hampshire. Wonderful to have you on the program. Thank you for joining us and for your ideas.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can find a link to President DeSalvo's op-ed again at our website, radioboston.org. Stick with us. We'll be back in about 90 seconds with sports, lots to talk about. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston.